one lot. And also along that lot line is a public utility easement that needs to be abandoned. And so we combine the request on public hearing. And with that, you know, we've received no correspondence either way on the subject, and I don't know if the board has, but got nothing protesting it. So.
Okay. And we'll open the public hearing. Is there any comment at this time?
Oops.
Come on up, ma'am.
State your name for the record.
Probably going to be very quick. So.
Yeah, it's going to be very quick because I'm not much of a speaker. I'm Jeanette Geitz, the one that they were talking about merging, and I just want to thank you all. If you approve it, I really like to have it merged because it's more privacy for our home. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any other public comment?
Make a motion to close public hearing.
Second.
Moved and seconded to close the public hearing. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries.
Make a motion to approve the resolution of approving abandonment of public utility easement and also approving the resolution issuing certificate of merger.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve the resolution. Any further discussion? George, any other comments? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, George. All right, we'll go to item 11 on the agenda, Planning Department discussion of possible action relative to consideration of Planning Commission's recommendation to approve a request and adopt a resolution for variances from County Code Sections 19.24.040, 19.48.220, and 19.48.110 to allow construction of a 22 by 28 detached carpet approximately 10 feet from the property line and 45 feet from the center line of the road. Property is located off Flint Trail, off Kern Road in the Lake Comanche Village, Unit 1. Susan.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Susan Grijalva, Planning Director. I'll keep this brief as well. This is a request for a variance from several county codes that so that a 22 by 28 foot carport could be constructed to approximately 10 feet from the front property line. The matter was taken to the Planning Commission, and they recommended approval of the variances subject to the findings and conditions that are contained in your staff report.
Susan, what's on the other side of the property line? Is it just a dedicated road right away, or
the road? It's a paved road.
45 feet from the center line of the road, but 10 feet off the property line. So the property line doesn't go to the center of the road. That
correct.
Is what I'm getting
correct.
At.
There's yes.
Okay.
I guess is Mr. Bowman here?
His representative is, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name. But
come on up to the mic, sir, and can you state your name again?
Yes, I'm Daniel Phippen with Delta Pacific Builders, and I'm representing the Bowmans today in this matter. I'm their contractor.
That's the only question I had is this carport-type structure, so does it need to be concreted in, so that's why it needs all the permitting, or what?
Well, the footings need to be concreted in, and it is a freestanding structure, but it because of the size of it, it requires a permit. And to get the permit, we needed to get the variance, and we have the Homeowners Association has approved this, the Planning Commission has approved it, and you're the last hurdle that we have before we can go ahead and construct this thing. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. We'll open the public hearing at this time. Any comments?
Move to close the public hearing.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Boitano, second by Supervisor Onetto to close the public hearing. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries.
I move to uphold Planning Commission's recommendation granting the variance with conditions and findings 1 through 3 on both of them.
I'll second that.
And adopt that resolution.
That includes the resolution, passing the resolution.
Yeah, it's also a request for variance, too. I guess I'd Yeah. What I said.
Oh, okay. I missed that part. I'm sorry.
All right. It's been moved and seconded to approve Plan Commission recommendations, the resolution, the findings. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carried. On item 12, Planning Department, discussion of possible action relative to consideration of the Planning Commission's recommendation to approve a request and adopt an ordinance for zone change from R1A Single Family Residential and Ag District to A Ag District for 9.59 acres located on the east side of Ostrom Road, 1 mile north of Fiddletown, to allow expansion of winery operations at Distant Cellars Vineyards.
Yes, again, Susan Grohal, the Planning Director. Mr. Chairman, you pretty much said it all in your introduction. This is a zone change request from R1A, Single Family Residential and Agricultural District, to A Agricultural District to allow the landowners to avail themselves of the allowed uses at a winery that would be allowed by changing the zoning to the Agricultural Zone District. The Technical Advisory Committee completed the environmental checklist, and the Planning Commission recommended or found that they had no technical objections. The Planning Commission recommended approval of the zone change to the board, subject to the or with the adoption of the mitigated negative declaration. The findings are contained in your staff report if you move to approve the request for a zone change, as well as to adopt the ordinance. It's contained in your staff report.
I have a question for you, Susan. Just a procedural question, but several areas on the environmental checklist were marked as less than significant impact with mitigation incorporated. I don't know myself. I would have considered them less than significant impact. For instance, the cultural resources, there's three areas that were checked, but you have to check those as less than significant with mitigation, even though, let's say, in one case, you're probably not going to find human remains there, but they're saying it's almost a what if, so you have to check with less than significant with mitigation.
Yep, there are state laws that cover what if something were to be discovered at the site. So there are, I guess you could say, de facto mitigation. There are requirements. You'll see that if there is an impact fee that's required to offset any potential mitigation or impact with that by mitigating that impact. But, yeah, with cultural resources, we never know if there's going to be any earth disturbance. If they're going to be constructing a tasting room, then they could theoretically encounter some type of archaeological or historical feature, and then there are rules and regulations that they would have to.
Well, it says right in the explanation, though, there are no known human remains.
Correct.
In the area, so I just don't see why you have to check. Why can't just be the less than significant or no impact until you find those human remains, if they are there? You don't. I mean, you're saying you're assuming that they might be there, so you have to check the with mitigation box.
Well,
B, you don't make the assumption they're going to be there before you find them.
Well, unless you've done a study, you can't say that there aren't.
Especially if you don't anticipate finding them there. So I don't.
Okay.
I think the alternative might be, though, that then the applicant would have to do a study, pay for a study, and prove that
there's nothing there.
Not there.
Well, then I think the wrong box is checked, because I don't think you want to do that study.
That's why if you do it this way and you say maybe there's something there, no one thinks there is, we're going to allow you to just check this box and agree that if you do find something.
Or you just check the box that said no impact.
But there has to be evidence in the record to prove that there's no impact.
There's no impact.
Yeah.
Well,
then you have to have the study.
They're not having to prove there's no impact, that there's no human remains there now by doing a study. So.
But there's a condition that says, if you find something.
Well, okay, I'll let it go.
Thank you.
If I was doing it, I would check the impact box on all those.
Well, I've got a few questions. Susan, one question is, does a change from R1A to A allow the property to be placed under a Williamson Act contract if it meets the other requirements of Williamson Act, where it otherwise wouldn't as an R1A? Or?
No.
No?
No, the property is too small for Williamson Act.
Even if they plant grapes on it?
Yes, yes. It would have to be 40 acres. It's only not even 9, I think, or is it just 9? I forget. It's a little over 9.
Yeah, 9.5.
Yeah. But what it does is it gives the allowed uses under the A zoning are the same as the allowed winery uses in the Williamson Act. So they're the same.
And that brings up my second point, and that is it seems this area looks very rural in spite of the fact that the surrounding properties are R1A. Are we going down a slippery slope here by approving ag rezoning for the sake of having much more commercial operations occur within a previously zoned residential area? I know there's been no complaints from surrounding members and so forth, but it seems a little counterintuitive if you have a residential area that's all zoned residential, 1 acre size, somebody compiles...
Zoned residential, 1 acre.
Isn't R1A? Okay, whatever. Okay, it's zoned R1A, though, correct?
It's zoned R1A. R1A is...
Okay, let me just finish my point. It seems a little counterintuitive that an area that's zoned residential, single-family, R1A, that allows a somewhat centrally located parcel to be converted to ag, and which therefore gives it the right to have all these different by right uses, such as special events and retail sales. And
right. Well, that is a decision for you to make. However, before you make that assumption, I'm going to look for a here's the map.
There are larger size parcels up there, too.
There are, yes. There are.
They are.
Well, the neighbors could always object, too, if they felt there was a conflict with the zone change.
There's a 7-acre parcel.
This is the property right here. And, thank you. And Robin's given me a zoning and a general plan map, but this is Williamson Act land here. This parcel is A, and there's a winery on it. I believe it Helwig's own that, correct? Is it? Helwig's own this parcel. These properties here are A zoning. This parcel down here is A zoning. So there's quite a preponderance of A zoning, and I'll give you the zoning map here.
It's right up by the Moose Lodge. Is it my Fiddletown? Yeah. Yeah.
Dotted area is the Williamson Act.
After supervisors get a look at it.
I am. Parcels in the area, but it has zones.
No, same thing.
So what we have is the zoning. The property that is the green with the dots on it is the Williamson Act. So you see there's a significant amount of Williamson Act acreage. The green that does not have the dots on it is just the plain A zoning, which is being what is being requested for this parcel. So you have some adjacent parcels that are A, and then you have the R1A, which is the yellow with the green crosshatching, is the R1A. And then the general plan, as you can see on this map, is all agricultural general, which is the general plan for agricultural, the Williamson Act. It's what's
is the blue, the Moose Lodge?
The blue, yeah, with the exception of the Moose Lodge, which is blue, which is public service. That's X zoning. That parcel was in the Williamson Act, but they did a non-renewal on it, and that was old Ziggy Boswick's piece. So the area is general planned for agricultural, and then because we have the three different zonings, the R1A, which is what we call the lowest of the agricultural zonings, and then we have the agriculture non-Williamson Act, and then we have the AG, which is our Williamson Act zoning. And so they're asking to go from the R1A, which would require them to get use permits to do a tasting room and any of the ancillary uses that are allowed at wineries under the A and the AG. So they're asking for the A zoning instead.
Thank you.
Susan, how what is the minimum size that R1A parcels can be split or created? And I imagine it has to do with on-site water and wastewater.
It does, but before that is the general plan dictates it. So R1A in a 40-acre general plan, like the AG, is a 40-acre minimum. R1A in a 5-acre general plan classification is 5-acre minimum, or 1 acre if there's public water, if it's in the RS general plan. So the minimum parcel size for the R1A is determined by the general plan classification that it is.
And out here, the general plan classification is 40 acres?
Yes, here it is.
But these are 7 and 9 acre size parcels.
Correct. They pre-existed the general plan. They're old parcels.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one. Since this is a amending ordinance, do we waive the reading?
Because it went to the Planning Commission, there is no need to waive. Okay. That acts as the waiving of the reading. So
okay.
Today you
got
take
it.
Action, and it becomes effective 30 days after the action.
And your findings are in the ordinance, too, so
that's correct.
Yeah.
No. Any comments from the applicant or representative? Peters, good afternoon.
Chairman, members of the board, I'm Robin Peters with Cal State Engineering. I think the staff report is really comprehensive, and we've touched on probably any other potentially residual issue. With respect to your question about cultural resources and the reason that was checked the way it was in the environmental document, I should note that when we do a grading plan for ministerial grading, once you know all this is said and done, our grading plans contain notes required by the Public Works Department indicating that if cultural resources or human remains are found, everything stops and we consult with a professional. And then I think, if I recall correctly, Public Works even has a bright green sticker that they put on our plans indicating the same thing. Stop. All a professional.
And that seems to make sense, but going to the level of with mitigation, that seems like it's taking it too far.
It's an interesting concept as it relates to a zone change, because you cannot condition a zoning amendment. So, whereas if we had a discretionary project like a parcel map or a subdivision, you could condition, add a condition of approval that indicated, pick up human remains, you stop and call a professional.
That seems to be adequate, but there's no assumption you're going to find
concepts.
Human remains, so why would you go any further than checking the first box? So, anyway.
Got you.
Okay.
Anyway, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Sure.
Said you were going to let it go.
You're out of order. So, okay. Any other questions?
No.
All right. Here
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. This time we'll open the public hearing. Is there any public comment?
Make a motion to close the public hearing.
Second.
Moved and seconded to close the public hearing. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Your action?
You know, I think it's a good location, and it's an ag area, so I don't have any problem with it. So I'd make a motion that we adopt the ordinance for a zone change from R1A, single-family residential and ag district to A, agricultural district for 9.59 acres located east side of Ostrom Road, approximately 1 mile north of Fiddletown, to allow expansion of winery operation at distant Sellers Vineyard.
With the finding?
It's in the ordinance, so with the finding, sure.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed?
Nay.
Motion carries 4-1. And with that, we'll go on to our last public hearing. Item 13, Environmental Health Department discussion of possible action relative to an ordinance amending the existing chapter 14.06 to identify the Environmental Health Department and Environmental Health Director in the role of oversight, establish yield and storage requirements for water supply wells, and clarify work to be performed by appropriately licensed contractors. The action is being asked to waive the reading and schedule for adoption on August 27, 2013. Mike.
Good afternoon, Mike Israel, Environmental Health Department. This item has been to the Land Use Committee. They reviewed it. Prior to the Land Use Committee in 2011, we held, Environmental Health Department held a workshop with local well drillers and pump installers to discuss the contents that are being proposed here. I had invited all of them to appear. However, hopefully all of them have worked, so they could not appear today.
But, Mike, you did have significant impact or significant comments from the well drillers and from the industry.
In 2011? Yeah, are you talking about in 2011 when we had the workshop with them? Yes, yes. So basically what you have before you, I think, is consistent with what consensus was in our 2011 workshop. As I said, it went through Land Use Committee, and it's now before you today. I know that Supervisor Onetto had several questions. I was out yesterday, unfortunately, but I did get them relayed to me. One of the questions had to do with whether owners could do work on the wells themselves. Certain work they can, drilling wells, rehabbing wells, destroying wells. State law calls for that to be done by a licensed well driller. However, other work such as telemetry, swapping out a pump, something like that, they can do, and that's cited in 1406-240 towards the end. He had a question whether or not the storage requirements would be required for ag wells, and no, that's a good point. The intent for that is for domestic sources to supply home. Storage would be required. So for section 14.06055, I would suggest we add a sentence to the end which states, this section shall not apply to wells intended solely for agricultural use. We do know, however, that occasionally wells originally intended for agricultural use are converted over for domestic use. Question?
Yeah, along that line, it's not just ag uses, but I'm also thinking, you know, what about if you have, like, say, a facility that's doing aggregates, and they have a well that supplies water?
So if it's industrial supply only? Rather
if something's being used for, like, industrial, agricultural, whatever it may be, they should be exempt.
Right, from storage requirements. Typically, you're going to have, if they're going to have an industrial supply for the well, they're going to be doing far more than what we're asking for storage or anything like that. They're going to know exactly what their demand is, exactly what their yield is, whether they need storage, if they're going to have peak flow events or that kind of a thing.
Sure.
You don't need to be involved in that. So, so how about instead of storage not applying to agricultural wells, how about wells solely for non-domestic use?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Better, I think.
On that same topic, and I agree with that, but it seems a little much that somebody would have to, I believe their storage requirement for fire regulations is 2,500 gallons, mm-hmm. and now you're adding another 2,000 gallons onto that. I believe it says...
2,000 gallons, yes.
It says 2,000 gallons storage shall be provided in addition to any storage required by applicable fire regulation requirements. That's getting a little much. Why can't the 2,500 gallons suffice for both?
It probably could if the building department agrees. At my house, I have a 3,000-gallon tank, and my storage for home flows through that 3,000-gallon fire flow tank. To me, that makes perfect sense. I've had conversations in the past with building department wherein they were not in agreement that that would work, that they wanted to see separate storage. But if they are in agreement that the same storage that we're talking about for buffering peak use for a low-supply, low-volume well could also serve the same fire flow purpose, I don't have any problem with that.
I'd want to know why the building department has a problem with it. Which is always...
If I recall, the rationale was, if you have a low-yield well and you have your storage for home use in the same well and you have an event where you're running your sprinklers and the washing machine, et cetera, and you have your tank drawn down, you no longer have your 2,500 gallons, do you? My rationale was, if you have a tank that is never, ever used for fire suppression and it springs a leak and it drains out and the owner is not inclined to repair that because they're not otherwise using the water, it's liable to be empty when the fire truck gets out there. Yeah. If that's part of your water supply for your home, you're liable to maintain it and keep it up so that it's always reasonably full.
Well, and the fact is the 2,500-gallon requirement can be alleviated with a $900 check.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I understand that too, but, you know, sooner or later they buy a fire tender. Yeah, I agree with that. You know, it should be tied into their domestic supply. That way they would maintain it.
How about...
I
was just going to say, if in order to address that, if we put a period after provided and delete in addition to any storage requirements by applicable fire, if therefore fire slash building are in agreement that it can be the same storage, then it's the same storage.
You know, I've got a question, though. Is this a requirement, a state requirement?
Storage? No.
No, this ran through the committee, the committee felt this was important enough. I mean, I got people living right up on Payne Road that have a half a gallon a minute. You know what they're doing is they're moving out, and they're selling their home to somebody else who's coming in and doesn't realize that basically you can't live on a half gallon a minute without really modifying your lifestyle. So it's just becoming a continual problem that's being shifted from property owner to property owner.
I could see having a minimum where you allow a home to go in, but otherwise I'm just looking at this going, this is putting a whole lot of conditions and whatever happened to that kind of freedom in America a little bit.
No, I don't think so. You think the people that move in there that have a half gallon a minute realize that, realize the impact it was going to have on their life?
They should do their due diligence upon before purchase.
Well, I think it's silly to think that you can actually live on half a gallon without significantly modifying your lifestyle and putting in some kind of storage so that you can at least have some kind of a functional life in that house.
One of the triggers that caused us to take a look at our well ordinance and revisit the well supply versus storage issue again, we had a building permit that was processed. The owners indicated that the water supply was a well, and it was an existing well, and they got the home through to some stage of completion, and they had a problem getting their septic system to fit. And then they started arguing that what's the problem with the well setback? It's dry anyway. And I said, but that's your water supply. It's what you indicated on your building permit. Oh, well, we have a well, but it's a dry well. And we're out on the McCollum River Canyon, and there's no point in drilling another one for supply. We were planning on hauling water. So hauling water is not a good idea for the basis of providing a potable water supply for new construction. State policy says that. County policy essentially says that. So we would like to avoid situations where people are building new homes, new construction, without an adequate water supply. So the intent of this is where it's difficult, provide storage. The well drillers indicated that if we just adopt something simple like a flat 2,000 gallons, it's kind of a no-brainer. It doesn't require a whole lot of math. I think consensus was that anything below a half gallon a minute is really tough, and simple storage may not be adequate. That's why we're saying if you have your water supply well that delivers a half gallon a minute or less, and you want to build a home on that, get somebody qualified to explain to us how it's going to work.
You know, I think if our past history, you know, we've got a couple of subdivisions in the county where people moved in and they had adequate wells, and all of a sudden they went dry. And those projects were Riverview, and the cop line come down and service them with 8,000 foot of 8-inch pipe. And then we had Toma Lane, and I imagine that was a couple 3,000 foot of pipe off the cop line to service them with water. And when I first went up to Toma Lane, when I was working for the water agency, where hoses run through the trees from somebody else's well to supply that house that had no water. When they moved there, they had water, but all of a sudden the wells dried up. So,
now we've had cases like this, Supervisor Boitano, too, come through land use where people basically are getting in a situation they had a poor well to begin with, and then they're looking for relief to try and get more water so they can have a functional life.
Had some late last year.
I kind of agree with both sides, but... you know, the problem is that I understand both sides of the situation, but I wouldn't want to be the supervisor to know about something like this where they can get less than 5 gallons of water or less than half of 5 gallons of water per minute, and then someone come in there and buy that house because more than likely the homeowner is not going to relay that information to the new homeowner. And we just had that incident with wastewater last Monday up in Mace Meadows, where a homeowner has lived there for 10 years, and now he's up there voicing his concern about the rate of the wastewater. And my question to him was, well, were you told what your wastewater rate would be when you bought the home? No. I said, well, why did you wait 10 years before you realized that it was this much money? And he goes, well, no one ever told me. The county never told me what it was, and the people I bought the house off never told me what it was. And I can understand both sides of the situation here. I don't want to see more government, but I do think we have to be able to notify the new people that buy this house or buy this property what their gallons per minute are going to be, so they don't come yelling at the county or the county supervisor saying, I was never notified about this.
I think there should be, I think there is, if they check, I believe most wells have a well completion report, and that would show where they hit water, what depth, and how many gallons, I think.
That's a confidential document. So if I'm looking at a piece of property and I'm thinking about putting in an offer, I don't have the right to see that.
If that's the case, I'll put an offer in conditional on, hey, I want you to give me a copy of your well report.
Right. Those are also not necessarily accurate over time. When my well was drilled 12 years ago, it was reported at 65 or 70 gallons per minute. Today it produces 5.5.
So what you're saying really is, so if we put all the conditions on and things change, they'd be null and void anyway, basically.
Yeah,
basically.
And then the government would be saying, oh, your well produces X, to Ted's point, and there's no way of verifying that.
The yields almost never increase over what they're reported on the completion report.
It's like old age, it never gets better.
Yeah. So if we establish a requirement with some threshold, it's not likely that over time the yield is going to increase and that storage requirement is no longer going to be of any value. In most cases, it will be the reverse.
Now, you have your well drillers that deal with these issues all the time, too. And we have some pretty common sense well drillers on there that we all know that were on your workshop, too. And they're pretty much in agreement with this, too.
Especially seeing as it all requires a licensed well driller to do the work as job security.
That's state law.
They see the problems too, so we went to where the knowledge was.
Yeah, so the dispute wasn't so much whether 5 gallons a minute would be the threshold for requiring some additional activity. The dispute centered more whether it would be a half gallon per minute floor or 1 gallon per minute floor. Some thought that, gee, below 1 gallon per minute, it's really tough. But I think we ended up with a half gallon per minute, make them do something a little bit more involved rather than just adopting the 2,000-gallon storage as being adequate.
So, Mike, let me ask you a question. In all the years you've worked in environmental health areas, have you ever seen a well increase to the capacity where it's almost double than what it was?
Not that I can really recall, no.
Well, you know, I could see having a floor that we're saying, hey, if you don't have X amount of water, you can't build there. And that could change. And if you got a gallon today, there's nothing saying it won't be a half gallon tomorrow. But all the rest of them is requiring putting in storage tanks. Is it a good idea? Sure. But do I want to be requiring that? I have some real misgivings over that.
The proposed amendment does not establish a hard and fast floor. As long as there is some yield reported, whether it's an ounce a minute, you can still make a proposal.
Yeah, you have an engineer or somebody come with a proposal, then.
Right.
Yeah.
So we can evaluate that. I mean, if the board is inclined to establish an absolute floor, that's relatively common in other jurisdictions, but that's not what this is.
This is through the construction process, too. So prior to ever putting a footing in, they should know what that well produces, so that they know whether they have to put a tank in. I mean, I put a 2,500-gallon tank in, and I had 11 gallons a minute. I don't know what it is now, but I know if I run two sources of water on the property at one time, it's not sustainable. Shut off on me.
And
without having that tank.
Sorry. Thought you were done. Sorry. Something else I'd wonder about, too, is when you put in all these water storage tanks, I mean, if you're not using that water, if that water gets above, what is it, like 65 degrees or something like that, doesn't it kind of start growing bacteria?
It can. So you need to maintain your tank. My biggest problem with my tank is I've got a lot of iron and manganese, and they tend to oxidize in the tank and settle out. I've not really had problems with algae growth or regrowth of any kind of bacteria. but the iron sediment is the
new. Yeah, purple.
Beg pardon?
Yeah, purple whites.
No, they tend to be
potassium permanganate is what you treat it with.
Colored, that's close. Yeah, yellow brown is what I come up with. So.
Okay, any other questions?
Well, I mean, there. I had a number of them just going throughout the document. So, I mean, we're kind of talking globally about the document like it's either all or nothing. We did make some changes there on the one, but I had other questions throughout the document.
Mm-hmm. Likewise. Next page.
Which page?
Oh, it'd be under 14.06100.
Well, I got...
It has the application, the appeal in writing. I think the applicant might be better.
That's a typo. Mid paragraph.
In what section now?
14.06100.
A, B,
review and appeal.
Mid paragraph. The application may appeal in writing. Should be the applicant may appeal in writing. The decision of the director to the Board of Supervisors.
Yeah.
And it goes on to say, Board of Supervisors shall, within 30 days after the filing of appeal, determine whether or not to hold a hearing on the appeal, or in the alternative, to deny the hearing of the appeal. And if it determines to hear, I mean, it almost sounds like we're making a decision before hearing the appeal there. It sounds like
I think you have
drafting in. I mean, how could...
I agree with that.
Determine whether or not to hold a hearing on the appeal... If it's been appealed to us, is there ever a situation where we would predetermine not to hear the appeal?
I don't think the board has the ability to meet and discuss without right. having a meeting. So
right. It sounds like a Brown Act violation okay. being drafted into the
you
document.
You probably have to have.
That's not new language, but we can delete that aspect if you like.
I concur with Supervisor Plaza.
I don't think right. you could somehow meet ahead of time to decide whether you're going to hear the appeal.
Unless you're talking about having like a regular meeting, and then is like a public hearing maybe? You have to be? You would have to meet to decide whether to hear it.
Like a public hearing?
And essentially deny it on the paper, on the or that you thought some merit was... I mean, Mr. Israel is right. I mean, this is apparently existing language that we may need to take a look at.
Wouldn't okay. it be simpler, Greg, just to change that to the Board of Supervisors shall, within 30 days after the filing of an appeal, schedule a hearing on the appeal? Period.
That's typically what we've done with other issues that are appealed directly to the board.
Yeah, it'd actually be easier to put it in that you'll hear the appeal within X number of right. days. Right. That way you don't have to have a go to a meeting to schedule the hearing which then follows.
That's not a, wouldn't be a public hearing. That would just be, right, Greg, that would just be an appeal hearing.
That's right.
Okay, did I do well?
Just a little before that.
What section, John?
14.06.080 conditions, where those conditions can be placed to have bacteriological or chemical analysis done. And I have a similar question throughout the document when it talks about that. To what threshold levels are we requiring? I mean, people do a test, get bacteriological or chemical analysis. To what levels are we going to hold their well?
The standards that we typically adhere to are Title 22 Safe Drinking Water Standards, the same that would apply to a public water system because, you know, if it's unsafe for a population, it's unsafe for an individual, typically, because you can't pick and choose which individuals.
I guess what I'm getting at is what is deemed to be unsafe continues to move. I mean, most of the municipalities right. around here have found that, with the Department of Water Resources always saying, you know, right. last year it wasn't polluting the stream, but this year, because we can test to parts per trillion, it is.
Yeah. And it's not always just because the degree to which you can analyze changes. A lot of times it's the degree to which it impacts public health, often as reevaluated, such as the case for arsenic. Typically, we do not request anything out of the ordinary for individual wells. For wells for land divisions, we do. For public water supply wells, clearly we do, and there are a whole other set of laws and regulations that address those. If we had a situation where there was an area identified in the county, for instance, that had excessive radiological constituents, and there are certain wells that have had radiological hits, we might require other testing above and beyond what is stated in the...
I guess my concern is where does it go from there? And on the next page over under 1406.110 is where we've inserted that language about prior to final approval of any permit for water supply or irrigation well,
mm-hmm.
the permittee shall submit these bacteriological and nitrate analysis of water produced. Doesn't necessarily say what the outcome would be, other than we may be direct to them to resample the well. But again, if you're talking, it says for irrigation well.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, irrigation wells
sometimes get converted to.
It's not uncommon for them to get converted for domestic use. The goal would be zero detectable bacteria, coliform bacteria, and nitrate levels below 10 parts per million nitrate nitrogen. If they fail either, we would not anticipate approving a well as a domestic source for potable consumption. If there are detectable coliform bacteria, the risk is just too great. It's an acute risk. You know, somebody can get sick right now. Nitrate, however, it's a little bit different. It doesn't necessarily affect everyone. Obviously, it's infants primarily and pregnant women who are at greatest risk. If they're in an area where the groundwater is contaminated with nitrate and they resample and it's persistent, we would be inclined to record a constructive notice document so a future buyer doesn't buy it ignorantly, and ask that prior to finalizing the well permit that they have point of use or point of entry treatment installed to reduce the nitrate.
You know, I have a little problem with one of your earlier statements, Mr. Israel. You know, it talks about irrigation wells can be converted to potable use. You know what? Does that mean we're going to then penalize everybody that wants to drill irrigation wells or industrial wells, saying you got to go through all these tests and analysis because somebody might convert it? If they convert it, that's their problem.
I don't view it as penalizing. The cost associated.
I do.
Okay. The cost associated is not that great. In the scheme of things, we're talking ballpark $70 for the lab
okay.
analysis.
Okay. So then what about if they come up with 46 parts per milligram of milligram in a liter of water.
If they exceed,
if they exceed the standards.
Right. So before they can use that for domestic use, we would like to record a constructive notice so that if somebody else buys property in the future, they're aware of what the situation is, and that for domestic use, if they install point of use or point of entry treatment, whether it's ion exchange or reverse osmosis.
Doesn't say that.
No, that was kind of the crux of my question. Where is it going? You know, once this is detected, mm-hmm. where is it going from there? Now you're saying constructive notice and treatment.
Would you like to see
probably
that spelled out in the ordinance?
I would think that inability to attain these minimum public safety standards for drinking water.
I would rather leave
necessitate the noticing and installation.
But I
would like to eliminate an irrigation well out of it myself.
Irrigation or industrial wells?
Any well other than for residential potable water supply.
Yeah, potable water supply. It's good to use for potable water supply. Hey, then they better test them.
We can make that change to make this section exclusive to domestic water supply wells if you'd like.
That'd cover commercial businesses that would be using it for potable purposes too, right?
Right, like if you had a restaurant or a school
yeah.
or something, sure.
Yeah.
That would be a domestic use.
Also in that same section, Mike, requiring an extension to the permit, item B under 1406.110, the owner submits an application for permit while the permit is still valid, grant one extension of permit for a period of 90 days for the sole purpose of allowing the owner to complete the work on the well. I just know my own situation. My well is in a situation where if you're in the middle of the wet season and some kind of work that requires a truck to get to it, it's not going to happen.
Sure.
You know, so I just thought the 90 days might want to be extended out to allow for
I had one year down.
What we typically do is if the well seal has been placed and inspected or waived, it's deemed valid in perpetuity. If we've checked the site and we've approved the site, but we've been called for no further inspections, in those well permits to expire within 1 year. If they say, hey, it's 364 days and I plan on drilling tomorrow and have a new seal inspected, a week later, we would grant the extension. I don't know that we really have a problem with maybe the term completion there is, maybe there could be a different term, maybe say annual seal inspected or waived within 90 days.
Some caveat that allows for ground conditions and access issues to be addressed outside of the timeline.
It commonly happens that a well will be drilled, cased, and sealed, but no pump hung, no water or power supply to it, and you can't pull a water sample or anything like that. So we've probably got a couple of hundred of those permits that are many years old that they're just waiting for the actual completion of the well to final the permit.
You can just add language in there in the end there. Subsequent 90-day extensions may be granted if conditions prohibit access to the well or something like that.
Our intent is not to have a 90-day, even if it's a rolling 90-day window, to get the permit finaled. So if you have a permit that's been approved, the site's been approved, and you can drill any time, but you haven't drilled, cased, and sealed within that year, but you plan to tomorrow, you can go ahead and do that. And once you've drilled, cased, and sealed, it's valid essentially in perpetuity, and you don't have to request an extension or do any other action. Just call for a final inspection when you're ready.
Okay, so once you drill it and seal it and put the annular ring around, then
you're vested, so to speak.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that an inspection that is done after the work is performed?
We inspect at the time that they place the annular seal, if at all possible. If they're losing the hole, a lot of times they have to pour it, and we will get a signed statement with their contractor's license number on it that, this is what I did, this is how I did it, the materials used, the depth, et cetera, et cetera. But typically we might be there.
Yeah, this is a tough inspection to do. Virtually impossible, I would say, after the fact.
Right.
I'm not on that.
1406.150, no person shall work on any well. Again, I kind of thought that was too broad and would like it to differentiate between a potable water well versus irrigation well.
Is that drilling wells? Like actual drilling?
It's drilling, rehab, and destruction. And it's whether it's a domestic well, a public water supply well, an ag well, an industrial well, the same state law applies to all of them. However, in hindsight and in conversation with others, there is other work that you can do and not be a licensed contractor.
Oh, yeah.
Swapping out a pump or, things like that. So we could delete what we had proposed, and this was on the suggestion of the contractors at the workshop, surprise, unless that person is an appropriately licensed contractor, we can delete that section because it's covered by other sections within this chapter.
I had a question also on 14.06, 200 water storage facilities. It says water storage tanks shall be designed and constructed for potable water use, and approved according to blah, blah, blah. I think like ag and industrial should probably be exempt from that, maybe for domestic use.
Right. That was one of the comments that was relayed to me, and I thought we could insert water storage tanks, insert, intended for domestic water supply systems, shall be designed and constructed for potable use.
Sure.
Supervisor Plaz, did you have a question before we left?
Well, we still left any well in there, even though it says unless that person's appropriate license, you chose to take that out.
That's an option to take that out, right? Because there is work on any well that non-licensed contractor, you know, owners, et cetera, can do.
So what are you saying again then? Are you proposing to take out the word any?
No, what I was proposing is to take out the underlined, unless that person is an appropriately licensed contractor, so that any work performed on a well.
Back to the differentiation between potable residential use wells versus irrigation well.
As far as work on those wells, the state law does not differentiate. They have to be drilled, rehabbed, or destroyed by a licensed well driller. But we're not trying to create anything above and beyond what state law is, but there is other work outside of those phases, pump work, installing telemetry, that kind of
probably
thing.
Putting a solar powered pump on the thing. I mean, there's any number of things, plumbing it into an above-ground storage tank. There's
other well work that can be done.
And that's why I'm concerned with the statement that says no person shall work on any well unless a permit's been obtained or unless the work conforms to the standards specified in this chapter.
I see what you're saying, yeah. That makes sense.
It's just a little too broad when it says any well. And no work on any well. Unless we define work to be as you're defining it here, drilling, sealing, or rehab.
That was defined earlier. Yeah.
Those are the items that require a licensed well driller. There are other things.
Yeah, there's other work.
Maybe what you need to do is differentiate the two, the other work that can be done by an unlicensed.
Yeah, because you contradict yourself when you get to emergency repairs.
I think under 14.0, the very first thing, heading for 14.06.020, kind of addressed that, because it says, except as otherwise provided this chapter, it is unlawful for any person to construct, repair, excluding installation of or repairs to pumps, telemetry, or other electric parts. Would that cover as far as being able to work on like your piping and all that? I think it will. Well, we know the pump is not piping though.
Right. So, we do not currently require, nor do we intend to require, a permit to be taken out to exchange a pump or to lower a pump or anything like that. Basically, permits are required for the construction, rehabilitation, or deepening and destruction of wells, the borehole and casing itself. Pump work, telemetry, those things are outside of.
Maybe we need that statement like you just said right there. I mean, that might address Supervisor Plaz's concern.
We can insert the term work and define it as those items.
Yeah, and I'd put it fairly early in that chapter, like where it says what I just read, because I read that as a little bit confusing at first, and I had a note. It says 14.06.020 permit required, except as otherwise provided in this chapter. I had parentheses, see under 14.06.240, because that kind of seemed to lay out what work would be done. Otherwise, if you read that and you didn't read it real careful, if you guys read that very, very casually, I'd say, except that otherwise provided this chapter, it's unlawful for any person to construct, repair, you know, you'd think work on a well. I'd think almost a blanket statement unless you really read that carefully.
Right. So work is somewhat defined in 14.06.020, but we can make it more clear perhaps by its own section.
Yeah, maybe limit to what you mean by work rather than saying all work. Is, you know, repairing, you know, that can encompass any number of things that doing some repair work on the well, but you're not affecting the annular seal or the grout or, you know.
Right, yeah. Or you could say any work that requires a permit under this chapter. If you find
well, what Mike just said, they don't even require a permit to put a new pump down the well.
Not for a pump, correct.
No, but
it kind of surprises me because you're dealing with electrical connections and everything else.
Well, you don't require a permit from the Environmental Health Department. Technically, if they ask, the building department will say yes, they do.
Sure, if they're working on electricity.
I believe that if they swap an existing pump and they don't touch the rest of the circuit, they don't set a new breaker, I think they can get away without requiring an electrical permit. But if it's a new well or they are putting in a bigger pump that requires a new circuit, if you ask the question, I believe the answer is yes. To make sure that it's done every time.
You know, that 0.24 talked about the qualification of pump installers. You know, it's one that pumps and purchases shall be installed by the property owner by the persons possessing C-57 or C-61, D-21 license, or other ones qualified by training or experience in the opinion of the health department. I think you've got to have that where a property owner can work on their well. Otherwise, I mean, hey, we're all, a lot of people are going to go broke. You have to always hire somebody to do everything for you. A lot of things people like doing stuff themselves.
Sure. And that's been there since 1990, the original draft of the ordinance.
You might want to put property owner. Does that include property owners like designees? Say I'm the owner of the property and I'm getting old and my kid comes over and I say, hey, fix that pump for me.
If the experience of the Environmental Health Department.
Well, I would think maybe how about property owner or designees, and then we have to talk to the health department. Save you some trouble.
And it's a situation, again, where we don't issue a permit. Are we going to know?
Probably not, huh?
Probably not.
It's true.
If somebody calls up and asks a question, my first comment is going to be, make sure you don't lose it down the hole. Because it's hard to get back out.
Yeah.
Okay, is there anything else?
Maybe install in their property owner or designee.
In 240?
Yep.
Okay.
Last one, 1406-290 regulations. The department is authorized to make such regulations and standards as deemed necessary for the protection of unilaterally or...
It reads unilaterally, but
it does read unilaterally.
To be honest, I don't know that we've ever actually developed any formal regulations. We've developed practices, how we deal with what's going on. I would say that the closest thing to a formal regulation is, up to date, in the ordinance, it did not specifically say that there would need to be bacteriological analysis of the well. I'm assuming, based on my discussion with the folks that drafted this, it was kind of a foregone conclusion. So no well permit's ever been finaled without a clean bat T. Is it written down anywhere? No. But that's de facto been the practice for, 23 years. That's probably the closest thing that we have to a...
My comment, Mike, is just that I think we can identify a host of troubles, local, state, and nationwide, that revolve around the governing body making a very generalized legislation, ordinance, whatever you want to call it, and then allowing all the regulations and standards to be developed by bureaucrats.
And to his point, I suppose if you have a bad back T count, you could superchlorinate your well and then test it again.
That's generally what we have a handout for people to do that. I can remember one well that was never able to get clean back tees, and they sample it out, I don't know, 10 or 12 times. And I think all the wells that we've had have eventually cleaned up.
You want to change the language on that, John?
I'd like any change or establishment of regulations and standards to be brought before the board.
Yeah, well,
I'm okay with that.
Just make it easy. The department can propose regulations and standards to the Board of Supervisors as deemed necessary for the protection.
The department is required to propose
okay.
regulations and standards as
well. Weller is required.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, can we, we'll open the public hearing and hear any comments, and then can we extend or can we move this public hearing down the road about 2 weeks to the next meeting and let Mike make these changes and
bring back a final draft.
I was going to ask if we could do that.
Yeah.
You can continue it to a time, date, and certain.
So we have a clear document to review. Okay. With that, I'll open the public hearing. Is there any comment?
Move to close the public hearing.
No, no, continue it.
Or move to continue the public
continue
hearing.
The public hearing.
To date certain of next meeting.
Jennifer, you have a date?
27.
27?
Okay. Motion was by Supervisor Plass to continue the public hearing to date certain of 8/27, right? Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Supervisor Novelli. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Now we're going to go back. Thank you, Mike. We're going to go backwards. Gene, you're up.
Poor guy. Sorry you had to wait here all day, Gene.
Free. Go back.
Just the most fun you could have.
Item 6 on the agenda. Comanche Water and Wastewater Systems, discussion of possible action relative to support for payment of expenses associated with well number 14, a two-year extension of time and a concurrence of future plan expenditures for fire hydrant repair replacement and service replacements. Go ahead, Gene.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chairman.
Had to throw that in, didn't you?
I had to.
It wasn't sarcastic, was it?
If we were in Texas, it'd be good evening.
No, and I didn't mean it sarcastically. I mean it sincerely. Chairman and members of the board, it was about 2 years ago, almost just short of 2 years now, that the Board of Supervisors passed a motion approving a $150,000 grant for the Amateur Water Agency Lake Comanche Village System infrastructure improvements. There were certain criteria that was required with that, and that was those conditions included a rate increase to correct a operational deficiency that existed with that system, prioritizing infrastructure that would be reviewed by the administrative committee, and also that there would be expenditure of the funds within 2 years. The Water Agency, this last July, adopted adjusted rates that do provide for not only the bringing up, eliminating the deficiency in operational expenses and costs, but also to start establishing a operational reserve. So we are on the road to improving our operational costs and controls, and also the revenue structure. Since that board meeting a couple years ago, the Water Agency has worked towards one of the first priorities, which was making some rehabilitation to well number 14 out in Comanche. Better than $12,500, almost $12,600 has been expended since that time. And today, one of the things we'd like to request is approval of those expenditures. And I provided information both to the administrative committee, and it's also in the package I provided the specific expenses that had been utilized. But also, the Water Agency would like to request an extension to utilize those funds, an extension of 2 years to be able to use that, just primarily because of the duration of time that we've just recently acquired the rate adjustments and put those in place. And lastly, that the board concur with some of the priorities of projects that we would like to spend the remaining of the funds on in working on water infrastructure facilities in the Lake Comanche Village. The administrative committee did meet on August 5th, and at that time there was discussion about the expenditures on well 14 as well as a two-year extension, and I believe there was concurrence to recommend to move forward with those requested actions. Included in the package is also a list of prioritized infrastructure, fire hydrants being currently one of the top priorities. You know, the hydrants that were installed have conflicting information on how to open the hydrants, clockwise versus counterclockwise. Service lines that are out there all need to be replaced. because of multiple issues of installation on top of electrical lines, direct burial, high voltage lines that are out there, as well as there's a breakdown of the material. We also seek to put a used emergency generator. There's no generators out there for many of the facilities. This would provide for reliability. Also, with respect to the SCADA equipment that's out there, the type of switches that were installed do not really work well with the SCADA equipment. And then finally, a tank liner for well 12, which is in poor condition. All of those items add up to more than $150,000. We won't achieve all of those, but the request is that we work through this priority of list, bring those items back as we expend funds to the administrative committee for approval, that then comes back to this full board for final acceptance of those expenditures.
At item number five, the tank liner, that's just a portion of what it would cost, isn't it? I thought you put significantly more money into that in the other tank liners through a grant process.
It was multiple liners that were installed. This is just one liner for one tank, and that would all be that it is. And I'm also not even including, in this particular case, I don't think it put labor, and we just put the $20,000 towards the tank liner.
Anticipate that covering the whole cost of the tank liner?
Primarily, and it's just for the liner itself.
How long was liners good for, roughly?
They vary based on the installation, but it could buy us another 10 to 15 years of life out of the tank. Those tanks are at the end of their useful life. They're all wooden tanks. They'll need to be replaced, and we're actually working on grant funds to replace those tanks. But, you know, we're talking about in upwards of $500,000 to replace a tank.
You know, I think that the generator is an important aspect down there, too, because a lot of times when you get a wildland fire down there and they have to cut the power, then you have problems. You don't have water, so.
Jump to that end, Michael.
Second, Brian, you had?
I was done, thank you.
Okay. John?
To Lewis's point on the generator, if power's out down there and you need a generator for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different pump stations and wells, is that gonna work?
No, I think he's gonna need more than one generator.
Well, that's just it. Are you gonna need 5 generators so that if power's out down there, all of those locations continue to operate? Or,
well, I would think, hopefully, I mean, in the wintertime, it wouldn't be as bad. That the big issue down there is when you have a wildland fire and they cut power out down there. Then you got a problem. Well, you don't have water, correct?
It's going to be pretty unusual, I would think, that power would go out at just one of those facilities.
Depends where the fire is, because believe me, when I was on the fire department, we had that happen down there before.
What do you think, Gene?
We do have an emergency generator for well 12. This emergency generator would be on a trailer mounted unit. It would be rotated. So we would take it to one site, bring up the water level for a couple of hours, then we'd move it to a different site and bring up that water level, and we just keep moving it around. Okay. And unfortunately, that's one of the things we do. We do not have permanent generators at all sites, but we try to have enough portable generators. So this is to provide an additional generator down in the Comanche area to be shared amongst those wells listed, and it would be rotated as during an outage.
Okay. But your system is designed so that process would be effective. You'd be able to bring up level here and then run over and bring it up there. Okay.
Correct. The exception to that is that at 8 and 10, they actually boost the pressure up in the system. So customers may see lower pressure during the power outage, but they would remain within water.
Gene, why don't you tell the board how important well 14 is? I don't know if most of the board members realize how important well 14 is, and then tell them our number one well down there and how important that is.
Well number 14 and well number 9 produce the vast majority of the potable water. 8 and 10 have been abandoned because of problems. We just still use the pump station. 6 and 12 produce about half the water that, or probably a third of the water that well 14 produces, or well 9. Well 9 and well 14 are hydraulically connected, so what happens when you start pumping hard on one, you notice it with the other. So it's kind of a very close aquifer. So 9 and 14 together, and usually only one at a time, produce, you know, the lion's share of the water for the Comanche area. So it's kind of a critical area. We've seen a decline in the capacity of 12 and 6 over the years. To where now they're only producing about a third of what they used to, a third to a half maybe.
12 was one of your main wells at one time.
That is correct.
Said on the fire hydrant repair, that's about $3,000 a hydrant?
It can be. Some of them we may be able to do for less. I think the goal would be is we'll just start replacing where we have to replace them, and those that we can repair, our operations manager has been able to acquire replacement parts, so we rebuild what we can rebuild and we'll replace what needs to be replaced. And this is our best estimate at the moment for what it would take for the remaining ones that are currently known to be inoperative.
You're going to prioritize those hydrants close to residential structures, closer to residential structures.
Correct.
I'd like you to get as many of those done as you can, because I know this a significant problem that the fire department has out there.
Right. And we're working very closely currently with Jackson Valley Fire Department as they're going out and inspecting all the remaining hydrants, and so that we have a program going actually with all of the fire departments that they're helping us to identify the condition of all fire hydrants. This list is prioritized. So before we move on down to lower items, we would want to make sure that we have got all the fire hydrants covered with any of the remaining funds, and I'm comfortable that that would occur.
Is this list prioritized not just of all the things that the system needs? These are the top five, but is it prioritized 1 through 5 so the tank liner for tank 12 is less of a priority than some of these other SCADA system improvements and so forth?
That is correct. So we have prioritized this list of the five most hot items that need to be dealt with in priority. This also takes in consideration those things that aren't just worn out, but things that were problematic from day one. And so this list comes up with those items. So there could be other issues that we need to work on, but these deal with problems that were kind of pre-existing that need to be dealt with, and then within this list, they're prioritized in order.
You have items 1 through 5, $162,000, and that doesn't include the reimbursement for the 12-6 for the well number 14 rehabilitation. So my question is, assuming that you get the reimbursement first of the 12-6, what are you going to cut out of that that list? You'll just go down the list in that prioritized fashion?
Our intent is to go down the list. We recognize that it's more than $150,000, so it's not going to fund all items. We'll have to supplement the funds for those to reach those goals. We may find that some items are a little bit less and some items are more. If there's an item that's more, obviously we'll have to bring that to the administrative committee, a discussion. At the moment, this would set the upper limit that I would expect, but some of these items we may do for less.
What I don't want is for you to neglect, go out of priority, and not do the maximum number of fire hydrants, and instead divert the money to 3, 4, and 5, or 4 and 5 other areas on the priority list. So, to me, I mean, the biggest issue out there is when people run out of water. So you absolutely need to be reimbursed for the well rehabilitation, but second biggest complaint I get out there is hydrants don't work. I get that from residents, but I also get it a lot from the fire department in the area.
Of course, then if the power's out, it doesn't do you any good not to have a generator to fill the tank, because you wouldn't have water anyhow.
So are you looking for a commitment from them that they'll spend $20,000 towards putting in fire hydrants, PDQ?
Well, I'd like to see it be more, but I'm... They can do what they can do. I mean, sometimes you go step by step, and doing a little bit is better than nothing, I guess. So, and there's too many priorities on the list. That's the problem.
Well, and that was to my question of how they're arranged. When item number two, priority number two, is replace as many as possible,
but your overall list is more than the maximum amount of funding, do you leave that for the last priority and do just that, replace as many as possible in terms of the funding that's left?
It's going to cost us over $1 million to ultimately replace all service lines out in Comanche. So what this goal is, to put $75,000 towards replacement of service lines, accomplish as many of them as we can in the worst condition that we're aware of. We're seeking other grant funding to replace service lines. So I know that seemed a little odd, that statement for number two, but that we know there's not enough money to do it. So we want to take a bite out of those that need to be done, some that are in the worst condition, and then move on. I'm comfortable, and in my opening statement, that the fire hydrants and service connections are the top priority. I think that clearly after that, an emergency generator is next. If that's all we accomplish with the remaining funds that are available, I'd be very happy. But those remain as the top priorities.
Part of the problem with the service lines out there, Gene, memory serves me, aren't they plastic pipe? And then some of them are just, they've laid a whole roll of coil.
Yeah, left the excess coil in the trench.
It's a horror story. And yes, they are the early versions of the polyethylene tubing.
Yeah.
They're decaying. What makes it worse, yes, for whatever reason, the contractor that made the installation through rolls of an in the trench. I don't know if they got paid by the foot or they're just lazy and didn't want to cut and make connections. The other issue that occurs is that these were installed in a common trench with primary power from PG&E. So we have, it varies, I believe, between 12,000 and 15,000 volts, kVA, of power directly underlying our lines. And if you think about it, what does the power lines look like? They're about the same size and thickness and color as the polyethylene tubing. So our crews are out there working with very high voltage, and they have a problem with the shielding on primary power as well. So it gets kind of expensive as we're very carefully digging with shovels around these pipes to get them replaced.
Helpful question. What's your percent of water lossage in that system, would you say, roughly, you know? Like what you treat to what you sell?
Not river pines.
Yeah, you know, we've been
curious.
This is an area that we've been working on, and this is going to be pure guess with a little bit of knowledge, and it's could be in the neighborhood of 20%, 15 to 20%. But this is what we've been focusing on. That's why we've been replacing the service lines. That's why we've been putting liners in the tank. So I need to get an updated number from our crews.
Thank you.
You know, and you call for line location with PG&E, and you know you have electrical in the ground, and you ask them how deep it is, and they won't give you a firm answer. But you can't rely on, well, it's only 2 foot down. It's approximately 2 foot down. Good luck. So I guess you're better off going out to the main and tapping a new line and bringing it in away from the old corporation stop, and then you have to turn the old corporation stop off, cap it off.
I can give you a pretty good idea where the power is. It's directly below the water line, anywhere from on top of it to 6 inches.
You sure it wasn't a tracer wire?
Okay, any further questions?
Nope.
The one comment I have made is that, this is not a significant amount of money when you look at the amount of problems that are out there, but at least it's a step in the right direction. But I think there are other areas in the county, upcountry, we've seen recently, they have some major issues, and there's other areas that were under county control at one time that might be looked at favorably to receive the same kind of treatment. I don't think we have to pull the money out of the water supply fund and take the principal. We can just utilize some of the interest that's generated and therefore not deplete that principal in the fund.
We don't want to deplete the principal in the fund, or we don't have the fund eventually.
The principal I'm considering right now is the core amount that generates a certain amount of interest every year. So
been pretty static since we got the $2 million from East Bay Mud way back when.
Yeah, but let's face it, no matter what you do, Comanche got an increase, some of the other areas got increases. The increases are nowhere near enough to put enough money in for replacement. Just nobody can afford the kind of rates that would have to be charged to get enough money in for potential replacement of a system with service lines in 5 or 10 years.
But like you stated earlier, Supervisor Forrester, it's a right and it's a step in the right direction. So,
anyway, with that, further discussion? Any public comment? Motion by the board?
I'll make a motion that we go ahead and approve the expenses associated with Well 14 and a 2-year extension of time concurrent with the future plan expenditures for the fire hydrants, repair and replacements, and with the service line replacements.
As well as the other prioritized items prioritized.
As well as the list of priorities.
As affordable, I guess.
And that the invoices be submitted to the county for reimbursement out of these funds with total reimbursement not to exceed $150,000.
Yes. To the admin committee for review.
Was that your second?
Moved.
Yeah, that'll be a second if it's okay with the first.
Moved by Supervisor Novelli. Is there a second?
That was it.
Supervisor Plas
seconded it with his caveat.
Just wanted to make sure. All right. Moved and seconded. So your date, 2-year date, will be August 13th of 2015 then.
Then.
So, with that, further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. All right. On item 7, thank you, Gene.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gene.
On item 7, Mule Creek State Prison, discussion of possible.
Yes, sir. We have the minutes, and then I can.
Okay, very good. You want to go start eating lunch?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Yeah, beat y'all to it.
Item 9, let's go to item 9, minutes review, July 9, 2013.
Got a couple little typos.
Minor?
Generally minor. Vice chairman was incorrect, and chairman was incorrect.
Well, that's no big deal.
After all, these are action minutes.
Yeah, I'm listed as the vice chair, but I'd like that also to say on June 25th, that in parentheses behind it, vacation. So it's documented where I was. Okay. Well, anytime I'm not at a meeting, I like it documented because certain people like to pick at that issue. I went to your home country, any other comments on the minutes?
I had an issue on the minutes. Let's see here. Give me a second.
What page?
I'm looking for it. I got lost my. I want to say it's on the minutes of July 9th, 2013, page 4 and page 5. There appears to be discrepancy under item 7F. One place it talks about that the GSA director, CAO, and sheriff negotiate a contract not to exceed $50,000. And on page number 5, there's a motion the contract not to exceed $60,000. So we need to reconcile if it's 50 or 60.
Well, it was 60 because the proposal, item 7F, was being described as approval of the $50,000 expenditure, but the motion was for $60,000 to add in
HHS
analysis of HHS repurposing,
okay.
Basically.
You wanted more money, didn't you?
Okay.
No, I just want.
I
won't say it.
Under that motion, I don't think I made the second on it either. I think probably another board member.
I thought that was odd.
And I have some minor changes. On the bottom in the next section under Jackson Valley, but they're very minor. Okay, so I'll submit those to our board clerk. Any further discussion?
Wanting to change on Jackson Valley? Hmm? What are you wanting to change on Jackson Valley?
I'm not going to change anything. There's two grammatical. Let's go to the third line from the bottom. In addition, he explained JVID is working on the phase number 2. Jennifer, it appears she stuttered.
I got a question on that, too, also.
Out yesterday. What's that, Brian?
Under that JVID, page 5, be about the couple paragraphs in the bottom, looks like. JVID is working with a rate consultant to specify a rate to the one customer during this transition. I'm not quite sure if...
No, right now there's one customer.
That what it is?
The recreation area.
Okay, all right then. Yeah. I'll withdraw any question I had there.
Okay, I need a motion then.
Second.
Both sets of minutes?
Both sets, yeah.
Is there a second?
Yeah.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. For the record, Supervisor Arnetto?
Yeah, for the record, I'm recusing myself because close family has property down next to Mill Creek area.
I need all the lunch.
Yeah.
Go out to the store and get some Copa.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's Brian, right out the Copa.
Yeah. We'll wait for you.
You never know.
All right, so we'll go back to item 7, the Mule Creek State Prison. You're out putting a letter together to respond to the draft environmental report for the Mule Creek State Prison expansion. Now, Chuck, before you start that, I think Chuck and I attended one of the workshops they had that CDCR had on this issue.
That wasn't CDCR. That was, I believe, the Stockton. You're talking about the meeting with
that
the representatives from Stockton? And
no, but did we attended a workshop a while back down that city.
Yeah, wasn't that the public? It wasn't meant to be a public comment, but just kind of similar to what Sleppy presented us
public
here.
Public comment.
Yeah. At Howard, didn't have it at
Evelyn Bishop.
Evelyn Bishop Hall as
Bishop
well.
Bishop Hall.
It was the first public hearing. Right. When they were the scoping session for the
I haven't been going to a lot of city council meetings on our own, but even there, I don't get a lot of feedback. We have two people here today, neither one of them has spoken to me about this issue. I mean, I'm very available to hear any complaints, and it's the first time I've heard from either one of them that they're opposed to the expansion. It appears to me that it's somewhat late in the process. I think we've kind of done our due diligence. We put a letter together. Chuck put a letter together after I've given him comments, and it appears that, also we've had Mr. Sleppy here. Neither one of the individuals were here, or no one else really opposing. I understand some people don't want any more prisons than I own, but it's kind of strange that you don't hear anything until we get basically on the 23rd hour of them going through the process.
And this really doesn't fall within our ability to approve or deny, right? I mean, it's a state function on state property. What authority do we have to...
Well, I guess we could oppose it. The city.
The only thing that we have going for us, if we can find something in the environmental impact report, we can make an issue with.
The city and the city and county did oppose previously, but we opposed, I believe, based on the expansion to Mule Creek itself. This is talking about a separate facility where they're going to house a different kind of inmate than what they have in Mule Creek State Prison.
Yeah, and I understand that, but the problem remains that, they've lied to us all along over the years. They weren't going to do this, and they were going to do that, and they were going to do this, and now we're down 25 years later, and here we are. So I certainly understand people reluctant to want another prison down there. And there was the advisory vote, too, as well.
And we had the water issue.
Public advisory vote? I mean,
yeah.
Countywide?
Yeah, but it does mean it.
We had the water issues down there, too, and I believe in 07, right? Where those people at that ranch across the street had to have water brought into them.
That's Scully's mother?
I don't know. The other problem is, I mean, I don't think it's a problem, but there's some problem with wastewater and some other things down there. It remains to be seen that they're going to step up and help solve those problems. And if they did that, then it might be okay. I don't know. But there's some individuals down there that just don't want to get along with anybody either. So
one thing I wasn't aware of, and I, or either that or I just forgot about it, but is Mill Creek State Prison still under a cease and desist?
I'm not aware of that.
I thought they had got out from that cease and desist. So one thing I would like to do is research that.
It wasn't mentioned in the EIR, which right. I would have expected it
but
to.
But I just want to make sure the one woman that spoke today, Miller, yeah. Leslie Miller. So when Ms. Miller said they're still under a cease and desist, so I'd like to just research that. Mike Israel should be well aware of it, but if they're still under a cease and desist, I sure want to mention that in our letter. But I don't recall that they're still under a cease and desist. I thought they were relieved of that. That would be my only change to the letter, is stressing that if we find that they are still under a cease and desist, but for some reason I don't think they are.
Can verify that.
Yep.
If that's there, I can modify the letter to address that before I send it out.
If it's under Greg, if it's under a cease and desist, that's for the establishment we have down here now. That wouldn't be for the new establishment, correct?
No, but why would you want to let them expand if they're under a cease and desist now?
Things are bad now. They're not going to get better by an additional.
That's right.
I agree with that, but it still would not. It would pertain to the existing prison now, wouldn't pertain to the new prison, because the new prison is going to have a new system in it.
It's all going to go into the ponds. Anything that the state can't handle, they're going to send it Ione's way.
Right, but that gentleman that came and talked to us, the guy from the prisons, he stated that this new system was going to be one of the state-of-the-art systems.
They lost things. So.
Not what they've got proposed. It still involves spray field.
That's always been the problem with this whole thing, and they always say a lot of things.
Yeah, they still don't know what they're going to do for sure, and they're still having meetings with the city of Ione and ARSA. Sean Rebay over what the ultimate solution is going to be. That's why in our letter we stress that we're looking for a regional solution. One, that would fly a lot better with the regional board, too, and helping Ione and ARSA out. But I would I'd like the board to approve this in concept and also authorize the chair and vice chair and CAO to make modifications if we find that some of the things that were said today are true, that Mule Creek is still under a cease and desist.
I think that's fine. I myself personally am not enamored with another prison down there, but that being said, the state's going to do whatever the state's going to do, whether we like it or not.
And with all due respect to Mr. Schleppi, I know he looked at me like I was calling him a liar during that hearing, or potentially lying, but you know what? Mill Creek State Prison, when they put that in, the state said they were going to do lots of things, and they reneged on a lot of those promises. So that construction road that they're calling temporary, I want to make sure it's temporary. And I think Chuck's language that he put in, the county will challenge any attempt to make this a permanent entrance, is right on point.
It's almost better that when we come to these concessions that we get it in a form of a contract so we have some basis to stand on, because if they don't do what they say they're going to do, what recourse do we have? Right. Other than spend a hell of a lot of money and then still get, you know, it kicked out of court.
Yeah. Well, we don't.
I wasn't at the last meeting with Mr. Sleppy, but my understanding is that these would be conditions in the environmental document as well. So we could use that as an enforcement tool. If it's in the EIR as a required mitigation, then they have to comply with that. Otherwise, we can use that to force compliance.
It's all the things that are not in there that they get you on, like hiring local, and well, we can't put that in there because, you know, we don't know if we can do that.
Right.
Chuck and I went down to Ione with a meeting with former Supervisor Doug Wellhoit, who's now the Chamber of Commerce Director in Stockton, and I don't think we have the hammer that Stockton had when they were putting in the medical facility there, the billion-dollar medical facility, which ended up costing, what, he said around $900 million. But, I mean, they had a significant hammer there with the Clark Kelso, who was the court-appointed, what did they call him? He was the court-appointed representative to make sure that they completed all the edicts. Greg, you know what I'm talking about.
He was the special administrator overseeing the prison medical system.
Right, and right. So I think with him overseeing that project, they had to get it done, so Stockton had a lot more of a hammer than what we have. I mean, they got things like a whole wing on one of their hospitals dedicated to inmates from that facility that they're paying for. And they got some other significant concessions that I just don't think we would ever get. But I think what we're asking for is reasonable. John, the one that we left out of here that I didn't think about until now is the employment side. Hiring as our subs, hiring local contractors. Been assured by Mr. Sleppy that he wants to work in that direction.
We're gonna try to establish that workshop to invite local contractors to attend once CDCR selects their top three general contractor candidates.
If they can. So, Chuck, can we insert one other paragraph on the last paragraph that after the primary contractor is selected, Amador County would like the state to work towards hiring local contractors as their. Just something along that line.
Well, supposedly the process they used in Stockton was once they selected their top three generals, then their top three generals' bids were scored to a certain extent weighted based on the number of local subs that they hired in their proposal. Because it's not a bid, he's gone out of his way to say this isn't a bid process, it's a request for proposal process. So therein, they don't have to accept the lowest bid, they can accept the best proposal, and part of that is scored on the use of local subs.
Can we stress, too, that by local we mean Amador County? Otherwise, local to some of these people means anything within a 60-mile.
Right. Yeah, good catch.
If I would imagine the same contractors are going to be bidding for this, then they're probably going to have preferred subs that they worked with before and may not even consider our Amador County contractors.
Yeah, our materials providers, there's a whole host of things that they could do for Amador County.
Okay.
Be encouraged to.
With that, are there any other comments?
I'm fine with a motion to send the letter conceptually with some of these amendments that we've made here. And
authorize the chair, vice chair, and
chair and vice chair
to amend this if we find in our research that some of the information we got is correct.
Mm-hmm.
There a second?
Second.
Seconded to approve the letter pending final language review by chair, vice chair, and CAO. With that, any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. The board will now go back into closed session and that portion of our meeting.
We have lunch break for lunch and then go into closed
session. Oh.